Hello, and thank you for listening to this Farah's podcast. Today, we are talking about wrapping up equality, diversity and inclusion within safeguarding in a school setting and the importance of doing so. We are looking at this specifically through the lens of race equality and anti-racism in safeguarding today. As we all know, schools play a hugely significant role in shaping the minds and the attitudes of future generations and really equipping young people for their lives ahead. And equality, diversity and inclusion, EDI, it is critical for schools, and where schools truly embrace that task of embedding a safer and a more inclusive culture, they should be better able to detect and act on inappropriate behaviours early. My name is Shenil Amin. I'm an associate at Farah's, and joining me today are the brilliant Coco Stevenson, who is currently the Director of Inclusion at St. Paul's Girls School, and Aisha Sanusi, who's Director of the African and Caribbean Education Network. Welcome to both of you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, hello. Thank you very much for inviting us.
So let's get stuck in. So starting with Coco, perhaps, can you talk a little bit about the connection between EDI and safeguarding and why they're intrinsically linked?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose it's relevant for listeners to hear a teeny bit about my background, because my background really and the experiences that I've had in schools have really brought to the fore why EDI and safeguarding are inextricably linked. So before I came to St. Paul's, I've worked in a number of independent schools, all in London. And my job before St. Paul's was actually director of pastoral care, or head pastoral care, they're called different things in different schools, or deputy head pastoral. And I was DSL there and dealing with many, many safeguarding incidents. And I am actually DSL here at St. Paul's as well. So safeguarding is very much part of my job description, being Director of Inclusion. And in the pastoral work that I've done, I noticed really quickly that there is a link between youngsters who have protected characteristics or perhaps vulnerabilities of some sort that don't fit into the protected characteristics on the Equalities Act, and our safeguarding lists or our vulnerable children lists or our lists of children with pastoral concerns. Mm. And that's an extraordinary thing, really, because it's very much indicative that the two are inextricably linked. And that's really what got me very interested in working more in EDI.
That's really great to hear. Thank you, Coco, for that context. Aisha, was there anything that you wanted to add there?
So yes, I can talk to this from an anti-racism perspective. I am the co-director of the African Caribbean Education Network. We initially started as a network of parents with children in independent school, Black parents, who were receiving a lot of the same, I suppose, interpersonal issues around racism, but also structural. And listening to the student experiences, it wasn't just the overt racism that was causing issues, it was the microaggressions and the more covert forms and how they later on went to impact students, I guess, physically and mentally. And I think a lot of that understanding around how racism manifests and turns up in environments is largely understood, misunderstood, and clearly constitutes a safeguarding issue, because our children were reporting over and over that what was massively impacted was their sense of belonging and therefore their sense of safety within these environments.
Yes, 100%. That echoes my experience of working with young people and listening to them and having the privilege for them to talk to me about their experiences is the disproportionate numbers of them who are experiencing problems across the board in terms of their pastoral care, their well-being and safeguarding issues, but that the effect and the erosion of well-being and, dare I even say, tipping into trauma in experiencing racism at school, whether that's what we might understand as overt racisms, but also microaggressions and that sense of belonging, that sense of inclusion, that sense of connectedness with the people around them.
Thank you both. And we've certainly seen a lot of that in our own work as well in relation to microaggressions. And, you know, often in schools, it being the misidentification of minoritized ethnic pupils, whether by mispronouncing their names or confusing pupils from the same ethnic group for one another. And I think the effect is that it really makes those pupils feel less valued, less othered, and that their identity to staff and to their peers was not by their name or their personality. Mm-hmm. But by the tone of their skin. And it can have a huge impact on their self-esteem and their progress in education as well, with some people sort of not choosing to pursue particular subjects because of that behaviour. So I think it certainly shouldn't be underestimated. And I know that there's some contention with the wording of microaggressions, because it almost seems to minimise the impact. But I think we must not forget that actually the effect can be really quite profound.
Absolutely.
Another question I had linked to this was, from your perspective, how do you think a school would go about trying to actually create a system where EDI matters are dealt with as part and parcel of safeguarding and not just as a kind of standalone issue?
Yeah, I mean, they have to be a part and parcel of safeguarding. And one of the things that I think schools have really taken on board in the last kind of 5 to 10 years is that safeguarding is everybody's responsibility. It's not just the DSL or people who work specifically in pastoral care, but it's absolutely everybody in the school system, the gardener, the cleaners, as well as the head and everybody else. And I think that D&I needs to be thought of in the same terms, and that when schools are doing their safeguarding training, which is statutory, that talking about EDI and talking about anti-racism and obviously other protected characteristics should absolutely be part of that. And so that means that it needs to be woven into policies, whether it's your discipline policies and what happens to people who are the perpetrators of racist bullying, also the recording of that information so that you can track patterns. And I think that training is, it's always problematic doing training in schools, but training is integral to this as well, so that everybody in the school system really understands the link between safeguarding and EDI and is prepared to call it out and to act on it, so that it's not just in a policy that's lying on a shelf, but that everybody is buying into it and doing it.
Yeah. And I echo exactly what Coco has said, but I would say that there needs to be a greater expansion of understanding how these issues occur in school environments. So what we know, particularly when it comes, again, I can only talk from anti-racism lens, but what we know is that up to something like 80% data suggests of incidents go unreported, and they go unreported because there is a lack of understanding, again, coming back to the microaggressions, around what constitutes these incidents for students. So whilst, you know, it's one thing to say that schools need to record racist incidents more, or, you know, incidents of discrimination more, but if there's no cohesion between how teachers identify this, we are not going to see much of this recording meaning anything in the long term. So I would say that training is integral to that, but that training must be underpinned by how these incidents occur in the school environment. And, you know, schools should really be asking students, you know, how this has occurred to them, what these microaggressions mean, what is the manifestation of your name being mispronounced time and time again, or somebody touching your hair. And that's not just the current students, but alumni who will be often quite more comfortable to share their experiences, and equally tapping into the parent voice where appropriate and teacher voice. But yeah, I think it's really important to underpin all of that with the understanding that most of this goes unreported because students for the moment still feel that they will be misunderstood in the school environment, and that, you know, there is issues here of re-traumatization, which, you know, to talk to the idea that often, you know, when school students leave the environments, they're most traumatized by the receiving of things that they did report by the institution versus the incident itself.
Yeah,
sadly, I think that's absolutely right. And of course, the whole issue is so much more complex than just having policies or having training. And I'm sure we'll speak to these things later on. But one of the things that I always find extraordinary, and I say this as a white person, that the majority of staff, teaching staff in particular in schools, are white. And they will be sitting on a disciplinary board or sitting in a meeting with parents deciding what constitutes racism or not. And so it's that notion that until everybody who's working in schools understands what it feels like and understands the students' perspective, of course, the perspective of staff who are minoritized ethnic groups as well, then we can't really get very much further. So it's really important to have representation on the staff body, in the senior management body, in the governor body, so that all trickles, that understanding all trickles down.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, both. And I think you've both really touched on the importance of having that kind of, you know, transparency, that conversation, allowing pupils to feel empowered, pupils and staff to feel empowered to speak up. And I think, you know, having that speak up culture is, it's really an inherent characteristic of having an inclusive organisation where you're going to be fostering a safe environment. And that's obviously important in any organisation, but particularly so in a school setting, because obviously, you know, where you're not empowered to speak up, issues are going to be swept under the carpet. As you said, pupils will just not talk about what they're experiencing. Harm will ultimately and could occur. And so why do you think that's particularly important in the EDI context, this kind of speak up culture? I know you've touched on it.
I think to start, that it's really important in the speak up culture, because so far the data suggests that students aren't speaking up. And there are so many dynamics at play here, such as, you know, power balances and, you know, not wanting to stand out from the environment. It's quite hard to expand on this because it's quite, you know, it's very situational to the school and the school context. And, you know, I suppose the balance and makeup of schools, the relationships that students have with teachers. But yeah, of course, it is important that this exists. But I think schools need to be very careful about, you know, saying, asking students questions outwardly and expecting that their students are giving their true experiences and their true feelings towards a situation. And I think if I could just go back to the previous question regarding reporting structures, particularly when it comes to discrimination, I've been thinking about this lots and I'm often asked the question. And I would like to say that I think many schools are, and Coco and I have spoken about this before, but perhaps overcomplicating it. And I think if they can get the training piece right there in terms of understanding how these issues manifest in their own environments, then that can easily be interwoven with the current safeguarding reporting structures that exist. And that's not just from, you know, staff reporting, but also student reporting. So I'm not sure what tools that you use in your environment, Coco, but actually just, I suppose now wrapping this back around to the speak up culture question, is if we are overtly saying to students that, you know, it's not just the overt issues that occur, it's not just issues of physical violence, but actually if microaggressions are occurring and giving them a very clear structure of what they look like, then we can foster a sense of safety and being seen by the minoritized students in terms of, I suppose, encouraging them and giving them confidence to speak up. But it has to start with the schools and the policies, and it has to start with schools saying, we are wanting to see you, we're wanting you to report, we're wanting you to feel safe, and then interweaving that with the current safeguarding systems that are already there.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we can come back to the safeguarding systems later, because I'm very happy to talk about what's out there and what works. But to answer Chanel's question, I think it's, I mean, it possibly goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that if you are already in an environment where you are in the minority and where your habitual experience is one of being othered or overlooked, or sometimes it's outright hostility. And as Aisha says, that can be comments, it can be behaviours, it can be a lack of representation that you are the only person or one of very few that look like you. But it can also be all around the school. It's the sorts of things that are on the walls and the messages that are in prospectuses and all of those things. And so it's really difficult to be the person to put your head above the parapet when it's only you. And I'm sure we've all either witnessed, in my case, or experienced, sadly, in other people's case, is that once you do put your head above the parapet, then you get labelled as being difficult, or some of the awful sort of tropes about the aggressive black girl or the angry black girl, all of these horrible things that then compound not wanting to speak up and not wanting to come forward. So we have to do all of the work in our schools around training, around representation, around policies, around behaviours, to foster inclusion, to foster belonging, to foster understanding. And it's only at that point when people will have the trust to speak up. And you know, I've seen how powerful it is when there's one black teacher in a school, and that the presence of that black teacher will enable young kids, young black kids, to speak to that person. but the burden should not be on that one Black teacher, of course. But incrementally, these things need to change in order to create trust, in order for people to speak out.
Yeah, thank you so much, both of you. I think you raise a really important point as well, Coco, in relation to the sort of physical presentation in the school and what's up on the walls, because I think that can also have a huge impact, can't it? If you're seeing, you know, paintings of people that look like you, and, you know, if it's a more representative environment, yeah, you're going to be more likely to feel like you can and feel like the school is open to sort of hearing about different views and perspectives. Whereas actually, if it feels like it's a very closed environment, there isn't that representation, there aren't teachers who look like you, who may have experienced a similar life path, then you might just kind of shrink into yourself and think, actually, I'm just not going to be understood by my white teachers or staff, so I'm just not going to bother to raise the issue when it comes about, or they won't necessarily understand when I've been the recipient of microaggressive behaviour because they just don't get it in the same way. So I think that's a really important point, and particularly as well what you then say about it being important to have that diversity of staff, but ensuring that that burden isn't overly onerous, and you've just got, you know, the one Black or minoritized staff member who's then receiving this, you know, all of these sort of disclosures or whatever it may be without the adequate support. I also wanted to touch on, moving on to a different topic, but on unconscious bias. And I think we need to be a little bit careful with this term. As we know, when it's used in the context of unconscious bias training, it can be problematic, because research has indicated, as I'm sure some of our listeners will know, that it can have little impact on behaviours or long-term attitudes where it is a tick box type of exercise. But more generally, unconscious bias are views and associations that are held in relation to a social group, and it can be particularly potent in relation to race in the education sphere. So I wondered how you see that playing out in the school setting.
I think it's played out in many ways, and I'm glad you've said what you've said about the problems around unconscious bias, because there are some problems, but I do also think that it's quite a useful way sometimes of thinking about the way that we think about things more generally, not just with regard to race, but particularly I think things like confirmation bias, when we overlook certain details because we're already sort of unconsciously looking for things that confirm our opinion, or affinity bias when we are, you know, we have a gut reaction that we like somebody, and so the information that we then take in afterwards very much confirms that we like them. So I think those sorts of ways of looking at unconscious bias can be really useful. And I think I particularly see it play out firstly in something that I already alluded to, which is if you've got a certain demographic who are in charge of discipline or in charge of sanctions and good behaviour, that unconscious biases or beliefs about what constitutes good behaviour or what constitutes kindness or what constitutes racism can be very detrimental. And I think that particularly in the recruitment processes, so that's recruitment of students as well as recruitment of staff, so teachers and O&A operations and admin staff, where there is such a lack of diversity often in the decision making, and where our unconscious biases, our unconscious beliefs, and sometimes, let's face it, conscious biases and beliefs can play a major part in the decisions that we make. Just to give a really basic example, if a youngster is not particularly confident about making eye contact, then we might make all kinds of assumptions about that person being rude or that person not being interested. And it may well be that they have neurodiversity or that they are just shy, and it doesn't make them any less of a good candidate. But those sorts of unconscious biases really do play into how we make our decisions, and can be very detrimental for the lives of the people that we end up saying no to.
I would echo again what Coco has said. And as I understand it, some of the problems associated with unconscious bias, or the two major ones, are sometimes it takes the onus off of discriminatory behaviour that should be called out, that isn't so unconscious.
Yes.
But secondly, because identifying bias in individuals doesn't allow for the what next and how, as well as for institution-wide accountability. As far as measuring the impact of unconscious bias, schools can only really do that by, I think, starting again with training and taking a deeper dive into the areas where bias is potentially occurring in their environment. So as Coco said, you know, in teacher recruitment, and I'm really glad that you've touched on admissions as well. That is a massive thing, particularly if we look at the independent sector and the lack of diversity for certain groups that often people think is associated with, you know, exam performance. And our research tells us that actually it's not. A lot of students are getting picked out at interview stage. But also, you know, it's in education sector more widely. We look at things like unfavorable grade predictions for certain groups of students. Coco said disproportionate sanctions as well. But also, you know, as well as in teacher recruitment, there's something there for teacher ascension too, because, again, we know that it's all well and good getting people in the door, but there is a revolving door of minoritized teachers when they do come into environments. And part and parcel of that is, you know, what happens structurally when we have, you know, constant recruitment of minoritized teachers coming in, but the SLT looks one way, and as you say, the governor board looks one way. And another thing that schools really need to recognize as well is, you know, is that offset when often the support staff, the catering staff and the cleaning staff all look completely different to the people that are teaching the students.
Absolutely. And I think in terms of training, you just touched on it, it really needs to be, where there is unconscious bias training, it needs to be impactful, it needs to be tailored, and it needs to be powerful enough to send a message across. And it's not just that kind of once a year tick box exercise. And I know, Coco, we've talked about this, how powerful it can be when you actually hear people talking about their lived experience and how, you know, unconscious bias can have such a profound impact on someone's day-to-day life. And hearing that from a person that faces it, I think can have, you know, a really strong and powerful effect. So that's important too.
So whilst unconscious bias training is, I think, can be valuable, I don't have many issues with it. I think it doesn't count for much if we're not teaching schools and sort of staff how to recognise how these incidents really turn up. So it's not just about the bias that they may hold. Actually, you know, it's very hard to link unconscious bias to mispronouncing student names. What are the incidents that are occurring on the ground for students every single day in the environment? And then beyond the training, which is where accountability comes in, or measurement, is, well, you know, if we're like you say, if you're looking at admissions or if you're looking at recruitment, how are you measuring these metrics? Where are you putting them? And then how are you looking at the development of them over time? So that can be in, you know, I suppose unconscious bias forms part of it, but it's not the whole picture. So yeah, I think it's for schools to look at the areas that bias can occur amongst other things. And, you know, those other things are also outwardly discriminatory occurrences. You know, how is, I suppose, bullying interwoven in with that, name calling and all of these things? Where are they occurring in every corner of the school? And then measuring all of that as part of a package. But unconscious bias isn't the beginning or end of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think linked to that, and it's a final topic that I think our listeners will be really interested in hearing, is how do you think schools can track and monitor those patterns of racism? You know, whether they're those overt experiences of racism or the more subtle. Just be helpful to hear your thoughts on that.
Shall I start with this one, because it's something that I'm sort of trying to work on and have been trying to work on in schools that I've been in. I'm going to refer to the sort of safeguarding model, because safeguarding has changed so much for the good. And so I think you need various tiers of measurement so that you are capturing as much as you can possibly capture. So with safeguarding, we recently had brought in the low-level reporting, and I think that's really, really important, because the low-level reporting in safeguarding captures behaviours, attitudes, things that don't feel quite right, that don't meet a threshold. And yet by having them, you build up a pattern and you build up an understanding, and hopefully you can prevent things from happening. So it becomes more that you can be proactive rather than reactive. So I think it's almost too late if you're only with racist bullying logging incidents as they happen. That's already overt. It means that most likely the culture in the school is allowing these things to happen. So you want to be capturing the microaggressions, the little comments, the jokes, I'm doing air quotes, which no one can see, that are deeply hurtful, offensive, upsetting and detrimental, but that are often brushed off as not such a big deal. So my concern is a piece of software that schools use. CPOMS is a piece of software that schools use. I personally prefer My Concern, but what they both do is they enable you to track all kinds of behaviours, incidents, activities, and you can choose your categories. You can choose your levels of complexity or your levels of seriousness. And I would just advocate having a seriously low threshold for any kind of incident and tracking them and thinking about what you then do once you've tracked it and then looking back over it a week later or 2 weeks later, because then only then do you get a real proper picture of what is going on in your school. And then you can adapt and review your policies, your training, all of your different strategies accordingly.
Yeah, I would again echo what Coco said. And I think possibly in defence of students, whilst I would like to see a seriously low, I suppose, level of tolerance there, I think it's unfair to place the onus on students, and that's all students for the moment, until schools take greater onus for teaching students what this looks like on the ground. So again, I come back to training, but training for teachers as well as the student body, and that's every single member of the student body. We tend to look at six pillars of anti-racism, and that will be interchangeable when you look at all areas of EDI. You know, this crops up in, we look at HR and recruitment, admissions, teaching and learning, policies and processes, community, and then that all goes into the data and monitoring that we must do. I think as far as teaching and learning goes, and Coco touched on it again, but really what we're trying to get is an idea of the culture of a school, and schools are responsible for creating the culture on the ground. So, you know, the curriculum is a great way to do that. How are we diversifying? You spoke about images on the wall, but, you know, outside of that, how are we teaching not just the minoritized students, but all students, that there isn't this one set of what I suppose success looks like or authority looks like? Again, in the community element of one of our pillars, it's, you know, I suppose we know that data and monitoring is there, and we're going to have tracking, I suppose, software or whatever it may be. But are there safe spaces for these minoritized groups to come together, whether that might be, you know, Black students, Muslim students, LGBTQ students, but for them to talk about their experiences anecdotally and their feeling of safety and the culture that they feel the school is building. But I guess all of these pillars need to come together to form the data and monitoring piece last. But I would like to stress that it's really for schools to take the onus on creating that culture in training all students and teachers before placing, I suppose, a disciplinary weight on students to get things wrong that they might never have been taught to get right in the first instance.
That's absolutely right. And there should be a distinction between tracking and monitoring and what that's actually for, but also what happens to those youngsters, or indeed staff, because you can have the same kinds of processes for tracking and monitoring staff incidents. And of course, as a teacher, I don't like to take a punitive track anyway. I'm not big on sanctions. Lots of people might argue with that, but it's always an opportunity for learning. Youngsters are inherently messy and they make mistakes, and we have to allow for that. And our job as teachers and educators is to help them. And you know, training and education is what we're all here for, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you. I think that's a really nice note to end on. And thank you so much to both of you. This has just been a really interesting and insightful conversation, and I'm sure it's given our listeners lots of food for thought. So listeners, hope you've enjoyed listening, and thank you so much to you both, Coco and Aisha, for your expertise and input.